Archbishop Marina Rapschlita. Well, last time we spoke about the Her Majesty the Queen's Diamond Jubilee and describing the Malchus Shel Chesed, which we are proud to live in. However, that has not always been the case. England has been a rather disastrous place to live in. I propose to do a series of three shirim. Today we're going to deal with England before the expulsion of 1290. And in the next one of the series, we're going to talk about the resettlement 350 years later, and mainly circling around the Rov of Berismark Synagogue and the events which happened then, which led him to write certain sforim. And thirdly, the 20th century. So, although it might sound like a history lesson, we're going to try and interweave into the historical facts various halachas and hashkofas, in order that we can call it a shir. In 1144, the very first blood libel of Europe, or the first reported blood libel of Europe, took place in England, in the town of Norwich. And a young boy called William was found dead, and the Jews on the second day of Pesach were accused of killing him for wine and matzahs. Quite a number of Jews were murdered as a result. And there were many anti-Jewish riots following that. And the way the Jews were treated with very high taxes was different to the way everyone else was treated. It's reputed that a man called Aaron of Lincoln was the richest man in England, and he left an estate when he died worth over £15,000, which was colossal money in those days. And his whole estate was seized by King Henry II, who tried to get back all the debts which were owed to him, which were even by noblemen and kings. In 1189, Elul, at the coronation of Richard I, or Richard the Lionheart, there were two Jews who came specially from York with a glorious present to give to him on the occasion of his coronation, but before they could arrive, the mob killed them, murdered them, together with other Jews as well. Included in them was Rabbi Yaakov of Orleans, who was one of the Baalei Tosfos. He was a pupil of Rabbeinu Tam, and he's mentioned in a number of places in Shas, in Ksubas, Memzayin, Zochim, Nunhei, Nidod, Avches. There are other Baalei Tosfos who lived in York who were involved and were killed in the massacre of York, which we'll describe in a minute. The Crusades were taking place around 1190. There was a massacre in Norwich on the 28th of Shvat, in Stamford Fair, 27th of Adar, in Bury St. Edmunds on the 9th of Nisan. There's a whole catalogue of nasty events which took place affecting the Jews. Rabbi Eliyahu, the Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam, lived in York, and his Yotzai is listed in the Luach Dovo Be'ito as being on the 8th of Nisan, which is when the massacre took place. And there is another one of the Baalei Tosfos mentioned as well, who I think I've written his name down here, Rav Yomtov Ben Yitzchok Mion, who was definitely inside the Clifford's Tower when the massacre took place. There was a blood libel in Winchester in 1193. The main road of Winchester is called Jewry Street. There's a street in London, Old Jewry, where the Jews lived. Fortunately, nowadays, we've got more delightful names of streets named after Jews when the country was a bit kinder to them. I think there are about five streets in this country named after rabbis. There's Adler Street in London. We've got Schoenfeld Square. We've got Rav Pinter Close. In Manchester, there's a Rav Siegel Close, after the Manchester Rosh Yeshiva. And there is one street named after a living Rav, Admelva Estrin, in Kingsbury, Rav Hul Close. Is there any more? Let me know, because it's very nice for a quiz on Hanukkah to ask these sorts of questions. But the list of sad events carries on. In Winchester, there was a blood libel in 1193. The Pope ordered that Jews wear a badge in 1216, and that was brought into England. In Lincoln, there was a blood libel, and many were murdered in 1255. And the chief rabbi, who was called Rabbi Eliyahu Menachem and Reb Moshe, was removed from his post because he refused to obey the king's order to levy a very heavy tax on the Jews. It was the Jews who were asked to pay heavy taxes to finance the Crusades. There was an expulsion of Jews from Worcester in 1275. Many were killed and imprisoned in 1278, alleging that the Jews had made counterfeit money. There was the allegation of clippings, that the coins were clipped because they didn't have smooth edges, and Jews were accused of anything that they could. There was another blood libel in London in 1279, and in 1290, on Tisha B'Av, all 16,000 Jews of England were expelled. Now, we will deal later with the massacre of York, because that's a subject in its own right. I would like to just deal in a short way with something a bit more cheerful, and that is the Ibn Ezra. A very famous commentator on the Chumash was Rav Avraham Ibn Ezra. Although he was born in Spain in 1092, he had lots of tzoras in his life, and he was widowed in 1140. He was very poor, and every transaction he did when it came to business failed. He was a great poet, and one of his poetries, he says, if I were a dealer in shrouds in Tachrichim, nobody would ever die. If I were a seller of candles, the sun would never set. Such was his luck, but he came to London, it seems, for economic reasons, and he seemed to be here quite a while, and there are many who believe he actually died in London, but there's no actual proof of it. He is quoted by the famous Rishonim, the Rambam, the Ramban, Rabbeinu Bechai, Abar Benel, and he refers to England as the land at the end of the world, because America wasn't yet discovered, so we were here considered to be at the end of the world. And he wrote in 1158 something called Igeres HaShabbos. On the 15th of Teves, he had a dream on the Friday night, and it was a messenger saying to him, I have a letter for you, and it's a letter from the Shabbos. I think we discussed this once fully with a text, with handouts, some long time ago when we spoke about the Zemiras of Shabbos. But just as a brief idea, he had this dream where he writes, it was Friday night, the 14th day of the month of Teves in the year 4919, that's 1158. I, Avraham the Spaniard, known as Ibn Ezra, was in that in the city of the island known the edge of the earth. I was asleep and it was sweet, and a man stood before me, take this letter, he said. I prostrated myself and bowed before God, and I blessed the God who gave us the Shabbos. But when I read the last lines of this letter, my heart almost failed me. I've always loved the Shabbos, and I couldn't believe what was being said. And the letter said as follows, I am Shabbos, the crowned law for the dear ones, fourth of the Decalogue, the Aseret and Dibros, on the eternal covenant between God and his children. Mon did not fall on the Shabbos as a sign to the future. I am a joy for those living on earth. I'm a pleasure for both male and female. Male servants, maidservants don't have to work. Animals rest, horses, donkeys, oxen. Everyone sanctifies me. In your old age, however, a fault has been found in you. For books were brought into your house, in which is written to profane the seventh night. It was held by some that the Shabbos was only starting on Saturday morning, and not on the evening before, and Shabbos was being broken badly. He says, I woke with my spirit pounding within me. My soul was troubled. And he looked in his house to see what was written. And he found a sefer, he says, which talked about Vayere Vayevoker, and that with dawn of the second day, one full day ended, for night time follows daytime. Some believe that it was referring to the Perush of the Rashbam, who held that before Matan Torah, and there are a number of Mefarshim who say this, the day started in the morning and finished the following morning, and it only changed at the time that the Torah was given. So of course we have to bring in Shabbos before Shkia, with custom 15 or 18 minutes before Shkia on Friday afternoon. But he says he found Sfarim which gave people this impression, and he felt like tearing his garments, but he couldn't, it was Shabbos. And he said, I vowed I would not go to sleep until I wrote a lengthy letter explaining when the Torah's day begins. And he wrote not just a short treatise, but quite a lengthy astronomy piece describing the years and the months and the calendar and how it works. And this is the Igeres HaShabbos. He also has another sefer which is not very well known, called Yesod Morah V'Sod HaTorah, the foundation of fear and the secret of the Torah, and it's considered to be the very first work written on Jewish philosophy in the language of Hebrew, because many philosophical works like the Rambam's Mona Vuchim, Rabbi Yehuda Levi and his Kuzari were originally written in Arabic and only later translated. And he wrote that this sefer is written in honor of Yosef Ben Yaakov, who seemed to be somebody who was teaching him and who financed him. And this was not a reactionary book. Many Sforim were reactions to certain attitudes going on at their particular time. And that's particularly so, which we're going to see in our next year, about the events in England when there was the resettlement and there was the Marranos coming out from, originally from Spain through Amsterdam, and the reactions which were happening then. But this sefer of his was not a reaction as such. It was the way he understood in Hashkofa the Torah. And he says how you can reach Torah in so many different ways and so many different kinds of limud. There are those who study the Torah properly through Chumash and Nach, there are those who go through the Gemara, those who, Halachas and Hashkofas, everybody can find something which they find easy to understand. But he says, although there are various branches of Torah study, each one on their own is not sufficient. For example, he says, you have to learn Hebrew grammar in order to understand the Torah. But it's not your whole life. Chumash on your own, it's not enough. Even though he wrote such a famous commentary on the Chumash, he said it's not enough just to learn Chumash. He says, Gemara, Talmud, that's the ultimate wisdom. But we must, he said, learn science as well in order to understand Torah. You will never be able to understand Hashem's laws unless you study science. And he was well versed in mathematics and astronomy and other sciences as well.
He was the one who described the fog in Israel.
Describes the
fog in England.
Oh yes, he wrote about the fog. Yes, we had very severe smogs there. I remember even as a child. Yeah. So an interesting point he says in the 7th chapter, he says, if a person's emunah is lacking, if a person doesn't believe in Hashem, then it doesn't matter how many mitzvahs he does, they are fruitless. Now that's not a cue to somebody and say, oh well, since I don't believe in God, I won't bother keeping any mitzvahs. But he was trying to portray the idea that there are people who are going around their daily lives keeping mitzvahs out of routine merely as a show, and he said that does not help them. It's no good. Their basis is emunah and acceptance of Hashem. You may have heard me once talk about the Vilna Bikurus. There was once a Bikurus in Vilna, and somebody was curious to know what what an Bikurus is. And such a learned town like Vilna. So he came along and he found the house of the Vilna Bikurus, and he looked through the window and he saw him busily preparing for Shabbos. And he follows him right through Shabbos. He sees him davening in shul and shaking and looking like he's davening with kavana, and he's eating his meals properly. So after Shabbos, after this Vilna Bikurus makes havdalah, he knocks on his door and he says to him, excuse me, are you the Vilna Bikurus? He says, yes. Well, how is it that I've been following you all through Shabbos and you're keeping all the mitzvahs? He says, why shouldn't I keep all the mitzvahs? Well, I thought you might do something lahachis, to annoy. And the answer is, to annoy whom? That's the story of the Vilna Bikurus. So what he's saying, the Ibn Ezra, is the emunah has to be the basis. Ein kelokeinu, ein kadoneinu. And then afterwards you can ask the questions, mi kelokeinu, mi kadoneinu, and so on. But he says every single mitzvah has a reason. Even if the Torah doesn't give reasons for it, even if you don't understand the reasons for it. But don't withhold your observance, he says, if you don't understand the reason for a particular mitzvah. He talks about the child who says he's going to refuse eating bread until he knows exactly how the land was ploughed and how the bread was harvested and how it was baked with the dough. The child eats normally and slowly begins to understand how the bread is made. He says that's the way with the Torah. Slowly we can take ourselves towards learning Torah in a whole lifetime to understand what it's all about. But he says the whole of Torah and the whole of Yiddishkeit is embodied in one posuk, Es Hashem Elokecha Tiro V'Oso Savod. The mitzvahs lo sase in Hashem you shall fear, and V'Oso Savod, and that's the mitzvah sase. Interestingly, that's in Devarah chapter 6, Pasuk 13. I don't know if that's of any significance, 613. Anyway, He says you should take the Torah literally wherever possible, but there are certain times when you can't take the Torah literally. When the Torah says circumcise the foreskin of your heart, it obviously doesn't mean that you're going to cut off part of your heart in Devarim chapter 10 verse 16. It means humble yourself. It says don't harden your heart like Paro hardened his heart. Or the Torah says in Shmos chapter 19, I bore you on eagle's wings. It's not literal, but then you will take that in its symbolic meaning. But everything else he says you should take as literal as possible, and he puts a great emphasis on the fact that nothing on the earth is everlasting except one thing, and that is your human soul. Only that remains. Nothing else is permanent. So that's the Ibn Ezra. Fascinating. If anyone wants to see a Sefer Yesod Mora, I've got a copy here. And there was, I believe, once an English translation made to it in New York. But I'm going to now turn to this massacre of York and certain lessons which come out from it. Because there are some halachas, actually, even though it's not pleasant to learn these, and hopefully one should never have to put them into practice. But what happened when this mob were being chased, and apparently it was because of a certain Russia who was owing a lot of money to the Jews. The Jews earned their livelihoods by being money lenders because of the rules of usury which the Christians kept to. And this fellow, Banis, I think was his name, he organized this mob to start chasing the Jews and to threaten them with forced conversions to baptize them. It is a traditional saying amongst many that there is a cherem now on York, and there is a custom not to sleep there overnight. But the London Based Din was asked on this, whether this is in fact an existing cherem, and there's a rumour that Rabbi Lord Jacobovitz said there is no longer cherem. But if you would write to the London Based Din now, they'll say they have no record of any cherem on York, and they will tell you that Jews did resettle in York after the massacre. But there is a custom not to sleep there. And as I said, the Luach Domavito lists two Balei Tosfos who were killed on the 8th of Nisan. And it's a very sad story because the mob outside said that if you come out from Clifford's Tower, which is part of the York Cathedral, if you come out and agree to be baptized, you will be alright and we won't harm you. And many of them inside the tower committed suicide rather than face the mob. And the halachic question, turning this of course into a Shia, is suicide allowed in Jewish law? Well, suicide is the last thing I would ever do. But humour apart, suicide is forbidden, and it's taken from the Pasuk in Bereishis Perek Tes. And your blood, it belongs to Hashem, so to speak. It's not for you to take your life away. So the Beis Yosef in Yerodeah Simon. Wow. Welcome. That was certainly a quick bris, wasn't it? So the Beis Yosef says, Yachol afilu Hanani Meshav Azariah. So maybe Hanani Meshav Azariah, who went into the fire, rather than bow down to the image of Nebuchadnezzar, maybe they should not have done this because suicide is not allowed. Talmud Lomar, ach. The Pasuk says an exclusion word, ach, namely, b'shas hashmad, at the time when there is persecution against Jews simply because they're Jews, yocholim saratzma, v'larogasatzma. You can assume that you may kill even yourself. Namely, if you feel you're going to be put into a nisayon, into a test, which you will not be able to withstand. So that doesn't simply mean that you're being forced into a baptism. It means that you fear that you will be put into that situation and you'll be unable to cope with it. Then you are allowed to take your own life. And this halacha is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch Siman Kuf Nun Zayin. And the Shach there actually comments on this, where he talks about when there is a time of shmad, the osam kadoshim sheshachdu atzmon, that those holy people who actually killed themselves, shelo somchudatam namud b'nisarim, where they didn't want to actually face this tribulation, kadoshim gemurim hein, they are really fully holy people. And he brings proof of this, and that's a Kiddush Hashem. This is a sad thing to have to discuss, but this is the context in which we're looking at the massacre of York. Some say there were 150 Jews, some say there were 500 Jews involved. But whatever happened, most of them killed themselves inside, and one of them was this Rabbi Yomtsev ben Rabbi Yitzchok Miyoni, whose Gemara is quoted in the Gemara in Yuma Memches, I believe. And Miyoni is one of the words which were used in medieval times for York. There's also Rabbi Eliyahu HaKadosh Meiravika, and some say Ravika was a medieval name for York. And they,
so you said he was quoted in the Gemara, but the Gemara was before York?
No, Gemara, in the
Tosus, yeah, the Perush HaTosus took 200 years to edit, and there were many Rabbonim who are quoted, and there are three Sfarim I've seen on different Gemaras called Tosus Chochmei Anglia. Machon Yerushalayim printed them not very long ago. And it lists at the beginning the various rabbis who it quotes. There's quite a number of rabbonim who lived in England. Many of them originated from France and Germany, but they were living in England, and they were Baalei Tosus, actually taking part in editing the Perush of Tosus on the Gemara. So these were Gedolei Yisrael who were involved. Now, the Shach brings down Nagos HaSmak, and he says, even if it's not the three cardinal sins, Gil HaRoz, Shvich HaStomim, and Avodah Zorah. So Gil HaRoz is immorality, Shvich HaStomim is murder, and Avodah Zorah is idolatry. Then one should rather give up one's life than do these sins. There are, in fact, two other mitzvahs where one should be prepared to give one's life, apart from the three cardinal sins. And one of them is Kiddush Hashem. Namely, if they make an edict that we are not allowed to do, say, to keep Shabbos or to keep Bris Milah, like we have in the story of Hanukkah, then you should be prepared to give up your life for those as well, because it's B'shas Hashmad, at the time of persecution, and it's Kiddush Hashem, because it's an issue relating to the future of Yiddishkeit. So that's Kiddush Hashem, and there's another mitzvah which the Torah tells us to do, and that's Kibush Eretz Yisrael, to conquer the land of Israel. And that inevitably can lead to loss of life. So if you're commanded to conquer the land of Israel, that means that you're willing to give up your life in order to do so. So that makes five mitzvahs, not three. So with Kiddush Hashem, those who kill themselves rather than enter in Nisayon Kadoshim Gemurim Haim, and there's a sad story in Gemara Gittin, Daf Nun Zayin, about 400 boys and girls on a boat who knew in advance that they were going to be forced into doing immorality, and they jumped over into the water and killed themselves rather than engage in what they knew they would be forced to do. So suicide is allowed, and Tosfos says, say, if one is not given a choice to be killed as an alternative, and one will be forced, then suicide is still allowed. Even in not the time of Shmad, even when there is no persecution, the Shach says in his next sif, one can die al Kiddush Hashem. Afilu al mitzvah kala, even on a light mitzvah. So they sought the refuge in Clifford's Tower. The warden let them in, but then the warden for some reason walked off. And when he came back, he found there was a whole siege going on. And this siege lasted a few days. They had no water with them. And with a shechita knife, they used for a suicide. And straight after the massacre, this fellow, his name was Richard Malabis, he went and burnt the debt records in York Minster, which showed that the Jews were owed lots of money. It's a big stain on English history. In 1978, Rabbi Lord Jacobowitz attended an event there where a plaque was actually put there to commemorate the event. And he stood next to a descendant of this. In an act of reconciliation, he stood next to this Richard Malabis's descendant. And in 1993, they planted daffodils there because daffodils have six petals to commemorate the Mogen David. That is the event. Let's now hear something what happened a bit later. In 1984, in the spring of 1984, a man called Rabbi Yisrael Chaim Levine from Gateshead was seeing off his parents who were going back to Denmark. I think they were taking a boat from Hull or somewhere. So they said to him, don't come all the way to the boat. Come with us just halfway. And he saw them off till York. And when he came back to the station, he realized that there wasn't another train for him going back for at least 3 or 4 hours for some reason. So he thought he'll do something useful while he's in York. And he went to the information desk and he asked a young lady there, do you know anything about Jewish cemeteries in York? He knew that there had once been Jews living in York. And she said, well, as a matter of fact, I know that there's been something going on recently in York University where a Professor Dobson found a number of skeletons because they're building a new Sainsbury's supermarket and car park, and he could help you. So he went to the site, first of all, where there was supposedly this burial ground, and it was empty. And it was in a street called Jewbury Street. And he went to meet this Professor Dobson. He told him he's a researcher in Talmudic law. And this professor was very glad to see him. He said, I've been researching this. I found 500 skeletons. And normally, skeletons were always found next to churchyards or churches. And this wasn't next to any church. And it was in Jewbury Street. And he also noticed that the direction that the bodies were buried was north to south. And they had this custom amongst Christians to bury east to west. So this Rav Levine phoned up Dayan Eretz-Troy and the chief rabbi's office and Rabbi Falk in Gateshead, and they all arranged a reburial to take place as near as possible to that burial site, right next to this Sainsbury's car park. And on the 8th of July 1984, a service took place when this reburial happened. And there is a plaque actually put on this Sainsbury's car park, although it's covered a bit with foliage. And Cohen may not really enter this car park because of the way that it's positioned. And that happened on that day, 8th of July 1984, in the afternoon. A few hours later, in the evening, there was a clear sky in York. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a small cloud and a huge thrust of lightning, which was seen by quite a number of witnesses. It's actually documented. You can Google it on the internet. Yeah. And this lightning struck the old part of the York Cathedral. Yes. The part which existed from the 11th century. The lightning conductors did not work. The smoke detector alarms did not work. And it took fire. And there are about 57 fire engines there trying to put out the blaze to try and stop it spreading to the whole of York Cathedral, which was one of the largest cathedrals in Europe. They said it was a freak lightning. It took them 4 years to rebuild it. And there was a pool of about 3 feet of water there from all the water from the fire engines. And that part, that element, the Clifford's Tower, where the Jews were massacred, was totally destroyed.
No, Clifford's Tower is not in the cathedral. Clifford's Tower is about
separate.
Half a mile away.
Is it?
Yeah, it's part of the cathedral.
It's York Minster. It's next to the
York Minster Cathedral on fire.
Yeah. Clifford's Tower wasn't there.
Clifford's Tower was
the Constable's Tower.
Yeah.
Which was it's about half a mile.
Right, I'm just relying on this article I've got in front of me, which is from an early Mishpacha magazine.
The Jewish records were in the cathedral.
The records were there.
In
the cathedral. Yeah. But the Constable's Tower, which is Clifford's Tower, was about half a mile.
Yeah.
The dry oak tinder in the roof of the south transept burned quickly. Much stonework was seriously damaged. The famous 16th century rose window was shattered into thousands of fragments. It took 4 years to complete to rebuild.
But apparently the south transept was paid for by the monies which they stole from the Jews.
It was paid for by the money they took from the Jews.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, 800 or 900 years have passed, but as we know clearly from Hashkofa, there is no such thing as a coincidence. A thrust of lightning just a few hours later, which happened on the 9th of July 1984, which just so happened the day I became a father, and it's amazing that nothing is a coincidence.
Even there was a BBC report that you can get on the internet.
Yes.
That spoke about this freak bolt of lightning.
You remember?
Yeah. No, so you can get it on the internet. I think.
Yeah.
There was certainly a connection between the two.
Today, as we said, we're living in the Malchus Shel Chesed. And we think that it's much easier to be Jewish than it was in those days. I mean, the hardships they went through. We listed before the various massacres and blood libels. And it was very hard to be a Jew in those days. But really, when all the Yiddishkeit is on our plate and so easy for us nowadays to keep, it leads us to the question, maybe it's really harder nowadays for us to be Jewish than it was in those days. Because now we got no pogroms here, we got no Inquisition, we got no libels, we got no shrieks of the Crusaders, but every single day we do have it harder because we're having to swim against the tide. Where every single day we've got nisyonos, it's much easier to go astray, and the assimilation which takes place is much more than it was then. Then Jews had to wear the badge. Jews were earmarked. It was very hard for a Jew to go astray. He had to keep within the fold. But the tests which we have nowadays on a daily basis, in a way, is much harder than just dying in 1 minute al kiddush Hashem. The Pasuk says, v'chai b'hem, we have to live by the mitzvahs and not die by the mitzvahs. And we have to do what we can. But if we contrast what was happening in those days with what's happening now, every single day we have to realize there are these tests and trials and tribulations, and we've just been talking before about the Asifa which happened in New York about the dangers of the internet. I've seen young couples ending in divorce simply because of the internet. And we do have to be careful how we are behaving in this modern day and age, and particularly how our children are behaving. But with all these trials and tribulations, the Torah has survived. There's a story about the Ponovitch Rav who built in 1941 his Ponovitch Yeshiva in Bnei Barak, and they were laughing at him. They said, you know, the Nazis are on the way, what are you doing here? But he carried on, and at the end of the war in 1945, a yeshiva bacha came to him and said, I want to join your yeshiva. And he said, where have you been? He said, I've just got away from a concentration camp, but beforehand I was in yeshiva. What did you learn? He said, I learnt Perek Elu Trefus. He said, tell me what you learnt. So the boy thought he was being verheard, so he started telling him all about the Gemara that he learnt in yeshiva in Europe, and his eyes lit up. The Ponovitch Rav's eyes lit up. He said, listen, I'm not verheering you. I'm just delighted to hear that the Torah has survived. Despite all our problems and the Holocaust which we've suffered. And he danced with him to the Chazon Ish's house, and he said to Chazon Ish, listen to this, he's been in concentration camp, he's been living Gehinnom in his lifetime, and yet the Torah is surviving. And from that the Ponovitch Rav built up the yeshiva. And Louis XIV once asked a Christian philosopher called Pascal, he said, give me a proof that the God exists. He answered, the Jews, the fact that the Jews have survived. So really, London is a much harder place to live in than Bnei Barak because of all the things going on around us. We have to reinforce ourselves, we have to try and do our best to make sure that even though we're not suffering the same nisyonos that our predecessors have done in England, nevertheless, the trials and tribulations we have in some ways might be even harder for us to put up with. And with that we can reflect on the Jews of York who died al kiddush Hashem. We will next time talk about the more cheerful times when Oliver Cromwell allowed the Jews back into England, and in 1701 the Bevis Mark synagogue opened and Rav David Nieto was appointed as the Rav. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Venice. He is listed as one of the Gedolim by the Chidor in his Shema Gedolim. And we will go through some of the events that happened in London at that time, which led him to write some very classics for him. And then after that, we'll bring ourselves jumping into the 20th century to look at the events which happened then. There's a choice of things to talk about, which I'll still have to think about. But if you've got any suggestions, we will look at that. And that will bring us already up to the Chodesh Elul. Thanks very much. So it was Shabbos HaGodol that it happened.
When they were building the stone tower, apparently they found the remains of the wooden tower.
It's on this mound.
Right, so Clifford's Tower was the constable, so he represented the king, because the Jews were under the direct protection of the king, and that's why they went for protection in Clifford's Tower. So it wasn't the cathedral, you're saying,
murdered.
York Minster was where the written records were kept of the debts which were owed to the Jews.
And that got destroyed. afterwards or before it, because there was no records of any debts being owed by the Jews.
Yeah.
And the Jewbury thing as well is, you've got that Sainsbury's. So it's actually an underground car park where this plaque thing is. And then opposite the road, where the horses and carts still go from, is the York Rut, the York Wall. And one other thing also which Professor did, because the Jews are buried outside of the wall. And the only people outside of the wall that were buried were the offcuts, or the Nabataeans, and the Jews.
Right.
So that's what Jewbury Street goes along the wrong side of the York Wall.
Yeah, I've got a photograph here of Jewbury Street. Jewbury Street today, and what is described by the photographer a deeply unloved part of the city, crossed by a busy road.
Yeah.
The lamppost bears the road sign Jewbury. Is it Jewbury or Jewbury?
Jewbury. J-W-B-U-R-Y.
With Sainsbury's car park across the road, site of the crypt containing the bones of York medieval Jews dug up during construction work. Thanks. Yes, I've got it here. In 1978, as a healing gesture, plaque was laid a short way down in the presence of the Chief Rabbi of England, Lord Emmanuel Jacobowitz, the Archbishop of York, and the descendant of Richard Malabies, the leader of the mob that carried out the massacre. And it says that on this night, the Friday the 16th of March, 1190, where they sought protection in the royal castle on this site from the mob, chose to die at each other's hands rather than renounce their faith, although there were some who came out and were murdered. And it quotes from Isaiah chapter 42, verse 12, "Let them honour God and declare his praise in the Isles." So presumably you mean the Isles is referring to the British Isles.
British Isles, yeah.
Thanks.
That's the tour guide explanation.
Right.
Some of them were murdered by the mob.
Yes, most of them.
Sorry.
No, only some of them. Those who came out and decided to give themselves up, where they were being offered forced baptism, they were murdered straight away.